This is a great time to be a Christian. You know, everybody knows that we live in a challenging time for the Christian faith. Challenges abound, strategies that worked before aren't so effective today. It's no longer a given that we're in a Christian nation, so to speak, where Christianity is a favored position. But you know, that's not entirely a bad thing. If you know anything about the New Testament, in the Old Testament too, we know that God's people can sometimes flourish very well in hardship. There's just something about our weakness which tends to attract God's strength. And living in a day when God would manifest his strength through weakness, well, that would be a great time to be alive. So we're just going to play with that idea for a little bit for a few weeks. Several reasons why I think this is just a great time to be a Christian. How increasing challenges are actually providing us with increased opportunities to glorify God and reach other people with his grace. I'd like to begin with one of my favorite New Testament passages. It's in Acts 17. It's a great text for a preacher because it's the only sermon in the Bible directed to people outside of the faith. Old Testament sermons, Jesus sermons, Paul's messages to Jewish hearers, the New Testament letters, they all speak to people one way or another who seeped in the Old Testament. But Paul's address to the Athenians speaks to people who had no idea who Jesus was, literally. Never heard of him before. This sermon was the result of a long journey of Paul's own personal faith, and it has a lot to tell us about how non-Christian culture can provide marvelous opportunities to share the gospel. I'm going to read the section. It's in Acts 17. I'll begin in verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace. Day by day were those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. And some of them asked, "What is this? What is babbler trying to say?" And others remarked, "Well, he seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Jesus was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you're very religious, for as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship is something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. And God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we're his offspring. Well, therefore, since we're God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he's appointed. And he's given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead." When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered. But others said, "We would want to hear you again on this subject." And at that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, member of the Areopagus, and a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. Paul came to Athens to escape a mob that was after him. It seemed like in this period in his life, there was always a mob after him. He'd go into a town, and he'd speak to the synagogue people, and they'd plant a church, and there'd be some folks who didn't really appreciate what he was doing. And there, a mob followed him from Thessalonica into Berea, and then they just barely got him out of town in Berea, and he kind of made like he was going toward the coastline, but then he cut south and then got lost in the big city of Athens. And the plan, I think, was for him to stay unobtrusive for a while. He left Timothy and Silas to kind of get the church on its feet, and then they'd come down and join him, and they would continue. But what Paul found in Athens made it impossible for him to be unobtrusive. Athens was an orgy of discussion about every topic imaginable. It was sort of a non-electronic blogosphere is what it was. you know, blogosphere, that term, to how the internet connects a huge number of people all over the world who like to share their thoughts with one another. The blogosphere is this online community of people who may have never actually met, but who are carrying on countless conversations every time. At last count, there is over 200 million blogs on the internet. Ancient Greece didn't have electricity. They didn't have computers. Their communities had to be face-to-face. But people would come from all over. You mentioned a lot of foreigners are mentioned right in our text. And they came for the purpose of conversation. That wonderful description in verse 21. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. That's what it was like in Athens. The latest ideas usually involved a debate between the two main philosophical systems of thought and 1,000 subdivisions, Epicureanism and Stoicism. People debated about whether we could change the world in the pursuit of our happiness or whether we had to bow and harmonize to a natural, godlike design. Well, to take part in this intoxicating debate, people came to Athens bringing with them every religion and philosophy imaginable. They got together in groups, in public squares, in the marketplace, everywhere. And if you just wanted to listen instead of participate, you could go listen to the council as they entertained some new ideas in the Areopagus, the Areopagus, or the Hill of Ares, renamed Mars Hill by the Romans. It was a place where philosophers would publicly debate and the council would listen to new things that came into town. It was, I think it was kind of an ancient version of YouTube where you could just kind of go and watch others, you know, express themselves for amusement and interest if you were wanting to do that. Athens represented the epitome of sophisticated tolerance and pluralism. Religions of all colors and shapes filled the streets with their own little shrine and idol. Literally, they were all over the place. Idols were like logos for ideas and convictions, the bulls and the birds and the whatnot, kind of like mascots of modern sports today. This orgy of idolatry was something Athens was very, very proud of. No matter how different they might be from one another, all the idols had one thing in common, and that was that they were all created by people, so that man was the measure of all things. In Athens, the fact that you could worship whatever god you chose or cared to invent was a monument to the preeminence of mankind in the universe. After all, who creates gods but gods themselves? That drove Paul bananas. It was very hard for him to walk through the streets of Athens. It says in verse 16, while Paul was waiting for Silas and Timothy in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. The term greatly distressed is a Greek word for like provoked. They use it for sharpening things. I mean, Paul was just feeling scraped and prodded and it was very uncomfortable. To the biblical mind, there's nothing more abhorrent than an idol, a human representation of God. Oh, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. He's not many, he's one. One God who created all mankind. We didn't make him, he made us. And pretending that we create God is the fundamental sin. And it's also the ultimate sin of mankind. It leads to every other kind of sin. Now, Paul was a passionate man. Maybe you noticed that. You know, before he became a Christian, he had been attracted to Pharisaism. Very passionate people, a group famous for their self-righteousness and their judgmental spirit. Well, he left all that behind. But his personality was to be zealous for whatever he believed in. And he was still pretty zealous. And those idols got under his skin. They bothered him. He couldn't leave it alone. He was supposed to be laying low in the city, waiting for his friends to join him. And all of a sudden, he's up there at the Areopagus, like he's on YouTube for everybody to see. Hi. As evangelical Christians, I think we can understand, though. Because a lot of us tend to be rather zealous about our faith. Not everybody, but I think a lot of us are. We're zealous people. And when we see idolatry in the streets of our culture, it gets under our skin, bothers us. Can't leave it alone. Provokes us. We find our nation's cultural idolatry personally offensive. But unlike many of us evangelicals, Paul had left all the vestiges of his Pharisaism behind. He was provoked, yes. He had to do something. That was his nature. But what he did was not to self-righteously condemn those idolaters. What he did was to deliver one of the most famous Christian speeches in history. What we read was Europe's public introduction to Christianity, and it was a good one. because Paul chose to see this idolatrous craving for the latest ideas not just as a personal offense to him, but as an opportunity for Christ. Standing on the Athenian street, Paul saw this great current of idolatrous ideas all going around him. But instead of condemning it, instead of running off from it into the hillside, on the other hand, he joined in. He saw this river of conversation as a means to reach the hearts and minds of all the great multitude that were participating in it. And on this day, in Athens, Christianity became part of that river. In a city determined to guard everyone's right to talk about whatever they wanted, Paul saw that it was a great day to be a Christian, and he was glad he was there. We don't have time to analyze this great sermon, but I want to point out two characteristics that made it so effective. For one thing, Paul treated these people with respect. Paul stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus, and he said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. I walked around, I looked carefully at your objects of worship, and I found this altar with this inscription to an unknown God, and that invites me, essentially, to talk to you today." Paul begins by commending the Athenians for their piety, for their pluralism. There are good parts to that. They respected everybody's religion, including Paul's religion, and he hadn't even told them what it was yet. So he felt welcome. These people were so politically correct, so intent on not offending anybody, they even put up a shrine to an unknown God in case they left anybody out. Athens had once been saved from a plague, and they didn't know which God had done it, so they put up a shrine to whoever it was, and that was the shrine to the unknown God. But it worked great for occasions just like this, when a stranger would enter into their midst with new ideas, and even before they even got to know what this new idea was and what this new God was, they wanted to honor him or her out of respect for the person who created it. And Paul accepts their welcome graciously, and he proceeds to introduce them to this new God they haven't heard about. And what he said was revolutionary. Paul makes the astounding claim that while people do indeed make gods in their own image, there's one creator God who made all mankind. And without scorning their beliefs, Paul introduces them to possibilities beyond either of their philosophies. A combination that has room both for divine sovereignty and for human responsibility. One universal God for all the families of mankind who created the human race with a capacity and a responsibility to seek him. A creator God worthy of all our worship because he will take our choices seriously and judge them accordingly. A creator God who is personal because he made us and we are personal. And therefore who can be known not just through the world he has made, but through revelation. Through revelation, by talking to us. This is a God who commands. This is a God who gives proofs. And most astonishingly, who has climbed down into his creation to overcome the death which our choices have earned us. Talk about the latest ideas. One creator God for all of humanity and all of the universe, a sovereign plan and human responsibility, justice and mercy, all anchored in historical revelation to make it true, culminating in one man's resurrection. Paul didn't treat these people as if they were children or simplistic pagans. He treated them with respect. He treated them as honorable and religious people, people who were struggling to understand life, but in the end only had unanswered questions. They couldn't bring it all together. And they were left in the end with nothing but a shrine to an unknown God. And Paul reached into their hearts, he reached into their hopes and their dreams, he reached into their mind. He wasn't just arguing for just one more God among many. He was offering them an alternative to all the other philosophies at once. One idea that ties all the other ideas together. He treated them with respect, spoke to them. Another thing that was remarkable about this sermon was he spoke their language. Notice the NIV in verse 28 puts quotes around two phrases, and that's to indicate that these are allusions to Greek poets who contemplated the relationship of man and God, they were not Old Testament prophets. They were Greek poets. Epimenides, the Cretan, he reflected on how people of his day were saying that God was dead. But he asserted that God lives forever, for in him we live and we move and we have our being. And then there was Aratus from Cilicia, who extolled Zeus as the supreme god of Greek philosophy and argued we should never leave Zeus out of our discussion because he's involved in everything and we're all his offspring. And Paul wanted to make the point that the living God is responsible for all life and he is universally relevant in any discussion. So instead of just trying to prove that, he just quotes people they already respect. Now, he's not supporting everything those poets said. He's just leveraging some of their insights. He builds on what these people already believe to show them that Christ pulls it all together. Not everything idolaters believe is false. Some is, some isn't. Paul helps his hearers understand that how the best of what they believe does make sense if you pull it together around Jesus. And by doing this, Paul demonstrated he was listening to them. This was not a one-way monologue. For Paul, evangelism with those who didn't know the Bible was a two-way conversation, figuring that if we truly listen to others, some of them are going to listen to us. And sure enough, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, we want to hear you again about this subject. And a few became followers of Paul and believed. Yet it started. The gospel of Jesus Christ had become part of the conversation. Paul had proven that Christianity could hold its own in any discussion of ideas. There are some ways in which we're kind of a lot like Athens today, aren't we? The pluralism of 200 million conversations, the idolatry which defines truth as whatever you want it to be. To look at internet traffic or text messaging or 24-hour news programs, one would think that many of us spend all our time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. We're still debating about whether there are divine laws that we should respect and try to live in harmony with, or whether it's up to us to change the world, make it a better place. You can call it conservatism and liberalism, postmodernism and secular humanism. The questions remain the same. The conversation goes on, and the questions remain unanswered. The conversation is going on today in the screenplays of movies and TV programs. It's going on today in contemporary music. It's going on today in the classroom and around the dinner table and around the water cooler, among all sorts of professionals, doctors, lawyers, teachers, clergymen. It's going on within political debates and the decisions of major corporations. The problem is, to my way of thinking, that today's conversation involves too few Christians. I think too many of us identify full well. I think many of us identify full well with Paul as he walked through Athens, saw that there was little fear of the living God, idols on all the street corners. And like Paul, I think a lot of us feel provoked, and rightfully so. We see a society becoming more pluralistic and less generically Christian, and we get sad about that. And then we get mad about that. God deserves better than that. Of course he does. We hate to see so many false ideas getting so popular. And a lot of us feel provoked. Makes us want to lash out or run away. Raise our voice in anger and derision, or else just walk off into some, get lost in a bitter Christian ghetto. More than once, I've grouched around the dinner table. I fantasize with Mickey about moving to New Zealand. You have to. Wonder if we can talk about that. No. If someone raises a voice against the church or against Christ, shout them down. If a magazine prints that God is dead, boycott that magazine until they see the error of their ways. But those reactions, they just take us out of the conversation. We become ostracized on the fringe where we shout at society while they just talk amongst themselves. At the Areopagus, Paul showed us another way. His zeal motivated him to get involved. But he got involved by treating the willfully and happily idolatrous people of this world with respect, entering into their conversation by speaking their language rather than making them learn his. And when I see that happen, it makes my heart warm, gives me encouragement. A few weeks ago, I was reminded of Paul's example by some folks in our congregation. There's this place I know. It reminds me a little bit of Athens. It's not as intellectual, but it's a place where ideas flow even more freely. It's a continent. It's a whole continent called Second Life. An online 3D virtual world created by its citizens. As of now, there are over 14 million of them. Last night, there were some 61,000 participating. There are mountains, there are seashores, there are thousands of houses and buildings, there are whole communities, malls, shops where you can actually buy things, historic monuments, castles, mansions, parks. Think of it as a computer game running 24/7 every day of the year that you share with thousands of other people where there is no objective but to build and live whatever kind of community you want. It's filled with computer-generated people that represent real people of every description, because the human participants of Second Life create their own representative in that world. They're called avatars. It's the ultimate expression of idolatry. You literally get to pretend to create yourself. It's amazing. By the way, if you come across a bald, mustached, middle-aged fellow who's wearing glasses and a Starfleet uniform, say hi. Second Life is a virtual attempt to create a paradise of our dreams. But the searching people, the creative people, the lonely people, the interesting people who participate have created something that really looks pretty much like the world we know. Lots of beauty, lots of aspirations, a whole lot of seedy sex, a lot of violence. There's no paradise. I've been trying to figure out how would you bring Christ to Second Life. And frankly, it's still a bit too much for me. But a few weeks ago, I got an email from two Second Life residents. I'm going to call them Rose and Carl. Turns out they're members of this church. And they invited me over to their place, a beautiful virtual home, this magnificent treehouse, in a virtual Christian community. And here's what they wrote in their email about their house. They said, "We've designed it as a place of ministry in a very corrupt game. And it is amazing how many people we are able to openly discuss our faith with. People from all walks of life, all over the globe, of all different faiths." And they wrote me to ask if they could post my sermons in their house so people could take them away with them. I said yes. The people they meet virtually. Rose and Carl remind me a little bit about the Apostle Paul in Athens. Not condemning this conversation, which had a lot of corruption in it, but becoming part of it to bring the gospel to it. Wading into a strange place where every point of view is welcome, provoked by all the idolatry, but taking advantage of the freedom to introduce folks to the living God whom they do not know. There are actually churches in Second Life, if you can believe that. There are people trying to reach folks there. Of course, you don't have to go to Second Life for that. There are people all around us right now who are having this discussion. There are people all around us who are making their own gods, and they are proud of it. They are trying to create themselves, and so far they haven't done a very good job. There are friends, and there are neighbors, and there are family, and we work alongside of them. They write the letters to the editor that get under our skin. They work hard for the legislation that drives us up a wall. But it's just their independence and passion for freedom that promotes a free flow of ideas, a flow which exports a lot of confusion, but which can also import the gospel. No, they're not going to talk to people who glare at them and shout at them. But there is an openness to those who are willing to show them respect and speak their language. And when the gospel becomes part of the conversation, watch out. Because it begins to draw people to Christ. Yeah, I think that living where and when people want nothing more than to talk about the latest ideas, I think that's a great time to be a Christian.